Good morning, Lloyd. We made it in.
We made it amongst all of that downpour out there.
It was treacherous driving, really. So if you are hitting the roads, you really need to be careful. You have to take it seriously. I come in on 94, and it was flooding in the lower parts, and we were all trying to stay in the middle because there's also flooding on the sides.
Yeah, and I come in on the lodge, and it was basically, you know, a lot of water on the far right, far left lane. The middle lane was okay. But, you know, you can, even though you're in that middle lane, if you're going too fast, you can slide.
You can hydroplane
still, you know, and still slide into someone. So you got to be careful when you're out there.
Give yourself room. People were not doing that this morning. I could barely see the guy's headlights behind me.
Oh, my God.
Give yourself room. As much as 1 to 4 inches of rain, depending on where you live. Check your basements. According to Click on Detroit, the highest totals of rain will be in northern parts of Livingston and Oakland counties and areas north of I-69. But we have that little water table for our baby outside that, you know, collects water if it's raining. And it was filled when I got out at about 5 in the morning.
Well, you know, meteorologists say an inch of rain equals 10 inches of snow.
Really?
So if you have, you know, 4 inches of rain, 3 to 4 inches.
Well, we got the email yesterday that all the officials are on high alert. They're waiting for calls. They're waiting for, you know, to assist people. But just be careful driving.
And look at, like you said, go in your basement. If there's some things, if, you know, if your basement is known to flood, go in your basement, move all those, you know, expensive or things that are, you know, sentimental to you. Get them off of the floor. Put them up on something because you don't want to get that damage.
All right, let's move into, again, the top news of the day, which is, of course, President Biden and, you know, congressional leaders are all back in Washington. The House met, the Senate met. To discuss what they think should happen moving forward. And we had, Parker, if you could play these bites for me, I don't see them on my computer here. First, the House met behind closed doors, and they are divided.
Right now, President Biden is the nominee, and we support the Democratic nominee that will be Donald Trump.
He shouldn't leave a legacy that endangers us, that we surrender to a tyrant.
Trump would be an absolute disaster for democracy, so I'm enthusiastically supporting Biden.
He just has to step down because he can't win.
We're riding with Biden.
So clearly they're divided. Some are saying, obviously, we're riding with Biden. Others are saying he has to step down. And one of the congressional leaders was asked, are you guys all on the same page when he was leaving? And he goes, we're not even in the same book.
Oh, wow.
The Senate also met behind closed doors, and Chuck Schumer had a very short, terse answer when asked about Biden.
Are you confident that President Biden has what it takes to win in November and serve the next 4 years?
As I've said before, I'm with Joe.
Is there the ability to throw out the virtual nomination?
As I've said before, I'm with Joe.
Do you agree with her sentiment?
As I've said before, I'm with Joe.
Okay. Weird, right?
Yeah, yeah.
He's only saying three words.
Yeah.
I'm with Joe.
He's a little irritated, you could tell.
And Lloyd, George Stephanopoulos, interviewed the man.
Just interviewed him on Friday. ABC News anchor George Stephanopoulos stirred a little controversy on the streets of New York with candid remarks about President Joe Biden's future. While out on Fifth Avenue, Stephanopoulos was approached by a pedestrian. All right, Let me get this right here.
Okay. We're with you.
Hey, how you doing? What do you think? Do you think Biden should step down? You talk to him more than anybody else have lately. And you could be honest.
Serve 4 more years.
You don't think he can serve 4 more years? All right. That's an answer.
Now, his remarks come amid ongoing scrutiny over Biden's age and recent debate performance. Stephanopoulos, known for his ties to the Democratic Party, has been critical yet measured in his coverage. Now, the incident underscores growing concerns with the party about Biden's reelection prospects. Meanwhile, White House reaffirming Biden's commitment to run again despite calls for some lawmakers to consider stepping down. And Stephanopoulos later told TMZ he regrets commenting publicly and emphasized his remarks were his personal opinion, not reflective of ABC News.
You don't think that person's recording. He was just answering a question, but that's how he really feels.
Yeah.
Especially if he didn't think there was a camera there.
Absolutely.
A Michigan House Democrat, it seems to be the first state rep to, you know, say Biden should step aside. It's Representative Phil Skaggs of East Grand Rapids. He said the 81-year-old president should, quote, pass the torch to a new generation of leaders, and noted the risk for Michigan Democrats down ballot if Biden refused to step aside. You know, Biden's coming here, Lloyd,
right,
on Friday, and it's like, well, who's going to be there? Gretchen Whitmer will not. She's on a book tour. Dana Nessel says she'll be out of town. Two people will be there, though, Representative Haley Stevens of Birmingham and Sri Tanadar of Detroit.
I wonder if the mayor, I mean, he's coming to Detroit, right?
So it does not say here in this Detroit News article. Oh, so we'll see who supports Biden on Friday here. Also, Donald Trump, he has been kind of missing for 10 days.
He
showed up at a rally in Florida at one of his resorts, and he said a lot of things, mostly what he usually says at these rallies, mm-hmm, but the golf issue came up.
Okay.
And he challenges President Biden.
I'm also officially challenging Crooked Joe to an 18-hole golf match right here. Underhill's Blue Monster, considered one of the greatest tournament golf courses anywhere in the world.
Okay. He's doubling down on this golf
theme. On this golf thing, man. What is this?
When, you know, there's serious things going on in the world. The golf thing is not that. It's not even real. This is not going to happen. Why are we talking about this?
It's not. It is not.
A little later on, we can talk about President Biden at the NATO summit.
Yes.
He welcomed the leaders of the world. He sounded forceful, and you know, he was reading from a prompter, though.
He's always pretty forceful when he's reading from that prompter.
It was State of the Union Biden.
Yes. Okay.
Not debate Biden.
Okay.
Okay, let's go local now. Samantha Wool.
Closing arguments concluding yesterday in the murder trial of Michael Jackson Bolanos, accused of killing Samantha Wool. That's the prominent Jewish leader in Detroit. The jury will begin deliberations this morning. Jackson Bolanos faces charges of first-degree murder, home invasion, and lying to a peace officer. Prosecutors allege Wool was killed during a break-in attempt, while the defense maintains that Jackson Bolanos is a thief but not a killer. On the stand, Jackson Bolanos admitted to lying to police and claimed he discovered Wall's body while breaking into cars. He said his jacket with a few drops of blood, Wall's blood, got stained when he checked to see if she was alive. Defense attorney Brian Brown, suggesting Wolf's ex-boyfriend Jeffrey Herbstman was the real culprit, pointing to Herbstman's initial confession and physical similarities to the suspect and surveillance footage.
This person running from the scene looks very similar to Jeff Herbstman. Haircut, glasses, even the coat he's wearing. Now, why don't we have the video of where this person ran to?
Assistant Prosecutor Ryan Elsley argued that the evidence, including surveillance video and blood on Jackson Bolanos' clothing, clearly points to his guilt.
The accusations they've made against Jeff Herbstman are unsupported. We are accusing the defendant of murder, and we backed it up with serious evidence. The only time that motion is detected in her home, after her phone stops being used, the defendant's right there. And then as he's leaving, he's got her blood on him. The blood tells the story in this case, and it tells the story of the defendant's guilt.
Well, now it's up to the jury to determine the truth in all this. And we'll be talking more about this with Todd Flood, attorney and managing partner at Flood Law. That's coming up at 6:35.
And coming up at 6:19, you can't speed now because there's terrible weather out there. But if you're thinking about it in July, you may want to think twice because the Michigan State Police will be out looking for you. They're trying to combat the problems we have here and the dangerous driving that's happening around here. So we'll talk about that coming up at 6:19.
In a concerted effort to enhance road safety across Michigan, the Michigan State Police, alongside over 60 local law enforcement agencies, has launched a proactive campaign against speeding. Throughout July, motorists can anticipate increased police presence aimed at curbing speed-related incidents and fostering safer driving habits. And joining us today to discuss this initiative and its impact is First Lieutenant Mike Shaw of the Michigan State Police. Lieutenant, always good to speak with you. Good morning.
Good morning. Good to speak with you guys as well.
Hey, now, so how does this initiative, Lieutenant, differ from your routine traffic enforcement efforts?
So that routine traffic enforcement is something that we do every day. When we have these specific enforcement activities like speeding or mm-hmm. drunk driving, or hands-free, things like that. Those officers are paid through federal grant money, and then it's kind of funneled through the Office of Highway Safety Planning here in Michigan. So what this means is it's more patrols that are actually out there concentrating on those particular events, with this one here being speeding. So it's not taken away from officers on regular patrol or answering calls for service or things like that.
Right.
These are officers that are paid for by the federal government to actually go out there and look for those activities that we're hoping to kind of curtail as we move through the rest of the year.
Lieutenant, do you guys patrol the lodge?
So we do patrol the lodge. Yep. The lodge is ours. We do patrol getting jiggy on the lodge, I think.
I was going to ask you, what is the speed limit on the lodge?
The lodge speed limit is 55.
Nobody goes 55 miles per hour.
Yeah. So one of the trouble spots with the lodge, to be truthful with you, is there's really no place to pull anybody over on it, right? And I think people kind of realize that. So like with any law, from homicide to all the way to just traffic enforcement, the main way that those laws are observed is through self-compliance, right? The drivers see the speed limit, they know what the speed limit is, and they drive the speed limit. Sometimes people don't do that. And then you have another group that may say, well, if I drive 55, I'll get run over. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to speed too. So it kind of gets away from there. But we do concentrate on the lodge the best that we possibly can. But we also got to be careful too that we don't want to create a bigger hazard out there. But you'll see some lodge enforcement during this campaign for sure.
I know I did. I saw some over the last week or so on the lodge, both sides of the lodge, north and southbound. And I saw the state police guys had somebody pulled over, and I knew that they were they were speeding. There was no question about it. The Michigan State Police traffic crash report, Lieutenant, showed this decrease in speed-related crashes and fatalities from 2022 to 2023. You guys must be doing something right if you got those crashes to decline.
So that's one of the things that we are looking for as far as doing this type of enforcement. What everybody says, right? Oh, don't you have anything better to do? You're out there trying to take our money. It's revenue enhancement. You know, all garbage excuses for why people are speeding, right?
Yeah,
so
right.
They don't have to get caught. But if we really look at what we're trying to do here, over 1,000 people were killed on Michigan roads in 2022 in preventable traffic crashes. Could you imagine if 1,000 people were killed by like drunk drivers or, you know, other type of violence or other crimes? And we'd be an outrage, you know, but for some reason, traffic safety is something that people don't get as mad about. So we also know that speeding, you know, goes with other risky driving behaviors. When we look at people that weren't wearing their speed belts, you know, over 13% of them in fatal crashes also were speeding, you know, younger drivers, over 10%, you know, 14% for motorcycle operators. So we know that speeding contributes to these preventable traffic crashes. So one, we kind of look at it for two ways. One is education, right? Meaning you discussing it, what it is. The other one has to be the stick, right? You can give them the carrot and then the stick. So there has to be some enforcement that goes along with this, or else people are going to, like we just talked about on the lodge, if you can't enforce it, they're going to take matters into their own hand. And there are those that have more riskier driving behaviors than others. But speeding, we know, does add to people getting killed, and we're hoping to change that driving behavior to get people just to slow down. And it's not even on the freeways. It's everywhere across the state. You mentioned, you know, 60 other places. We're seeing it not only on our freeways, but we're seeing it, you know, what we call topside, our neighborhood streets. I know where I live. There's a couple of folks that I've had to have a chat with that were speeding in my neighborhood. And you don't get to do that. So that's what those local officers are concentrating on, is making those neighborhoods safe in their own communities.
Speaking of that stick, how much are speeding tickets? How much will it cost you?
Yeah. So it varies from court to court. It kind of depends on where you're at and what additional fines and costs are. But, you know, some courts, it can get up there about $250, $300. And, you know, then you got to worry about Jake from State Farm.
That's right. That's right.
As well. So that kind of adds to it. But And what we're really, really trying to do is really get people to think about their driving behavior, because you don't have to be a trooper or a cop or anybody else. When you're driving down there, we see a lot of people that are taking a lot of risky chances while they're out there driving. And unfortunately, that leads to traffic deaths. And, you know, in 23, I think our stats are coming out pretty far. We're going to be over 1,000 again, 1,000 people that died in preventable traffic crashes mm-hmm. because they did something they weren't supposed to do.
Lieutenant, before I let you go, is your department involved in the investigation into this block club or this block party shooting on the east side on Sunday morning?
So we do have a partnership with the Detroit Police Department. It's called the Homicide Task Force. And what that is made up is from detectives from both MSP and the Detroit Police Department. And then it's led by, it swaps back and forth every time that there's an incident. So one department doesn't get caught with all of them.
Uh-huh.
Currently, this one is led by the Detroit Police Department with assistance from our detectives on that task force.
Okay, very good. Well, Lieutenant Mike Shaw, Michigan State Police, 2nd District, we appreciate you and what you guys are doing out there on the roads, keeping us safe and calming down the folks on the lodge and other places as well.
Oh, it's 696. It's everywhere.
It's everywhere. All right.
It is.
Thank you so much.
All right, take care now.
You know, I got friends who told me, like, man, I got a ticket today. I was like, did you? Yeah. You know, I said, were you on the lodge? No, I was over on the... I said, listen, they're cracking down.
They're out.
In July, it's state police and 60 other law enforcement agencies that are working together in July to crack down on these speeders. So
I appreciate that effort because people are going very, very fast on our highways around here.
So coming up, the Samantha Wall trial, there is conflicting narratives here. You know, he wasn't there. I didn't do it. I didn't kill her. Then you have what?
Is there reasonable doubt?
Yeah. So all of that, we need to find out what's going to happen. They're going to start deliberating today. Todd Flood, attorney and managing partner of Flood Law, is going to join us coming up with more on that at 6:35. A Wayne County jury will begin deliberating today whether Michael Jackson Bolanos murdered Jewish leader Samantha Wall in her Detroit townhouse during a home invasion, or if he was simply in the wrong place at the wrong time, as his attorney contends. The trial, which has lasted 4.5 weeks, concluded with the Wayne County prosecutor arguing that numerous coincidences in the case point to Jackson Bolanos as the killer. And joining us on the JR Morning Live line with his insights on the case is Todd Flood, attorney and managing partner at Flood Law. Counselor, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
So how do you think this jury, Todd, is going to weigh the prosecution's argument that there's like too many coincidences against the defense's claim that Jackson Bolanos was just simply in the wrong place at the wrong time?
I think if one can predict a jury, you know, it's like tea leaf reading. It's next to impossible. But hopefully, you know, they use their common sense and that didn't get checked out when they were put into the jury box in the jury chair. So there's a lot of questions in this case. And if you ask what is the definition of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, it's not all doubt. It's not beyond a shadow of a doubt. Did they prove each and every element of this case beyond a reasonable doubt? The prosecution nails the points about how many times do you have to lie, right? He lied 8 times, and they played all the different stories. And how do you get the blood in the backpack? And why do you wash the jacket? If you're such a good Samaritan, why didn't you call the police? Defense, on the other side of the coin, they get into, wait a second, I'm the wrong person. I'm a minority. There's a white person, female, that it doesn't look so good, and I'm a thief. Right. So, you know, you put that into the equation. No dummy's going to, you know, I didn't do this. I'm out of here. That type of activity or that type of theory. I think and you had another person that confessed to the crime, the ex-boyfriend. And the police didn't do everything that they were supposed to do. They didn't check for all the evidence in the ex-boyfriend's house. He, on the night of the search, has a bonfire. Did you search the bonfire? No, I didn't search the bonfire. You could have seen the eyes of the trooper, you know, light up on that. Uh-huh. Because what happens if the, you know, the murder weapon, the knife, was in the remnants of that fire?
Because that was never found, right? The knife was not found, right?
The knife was not found. There was a knife that could have been, but didn't match. And then there was one other big piece of the puzzle. There was a pillow that was found down by the landing, apparently, or had a big footprint in it. And the prosecution never brought that out. And the defense said, because the definition of reasonable doubt, it can grow from the lack of evidence, in quotations, lack of evidence. Uh-huh. Well, why didn't they bring that out? You know for certain that if it did match anything of the defendants, they would have put that in front of you, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, but they didn't. The lack of evidence. So, you know, there's questions. Sitting in that jury, I can tell you this, they are taking this case very seriously. They paid attention. The prosecution was, I thought, excellent in its summation of putting things in a methodical, linear way of having a good explanation. And the defense pounced on certain things that there's too many questions and not enough answers.
Todd, the concrete evidence they have for Jackson Bolanos is these videos of him walking in the neighborhood, but they can't prove what happened inside her home.
They can't. That's the $64 million question. Yeah, that's the problem. They don't have fingerprints. They don't have any DNA. They don't have his DNA. There's no scratches on him. There's no, you know, where he's trying to, you see him leaving the scene. Are those the actions of someone that just murdered somebody? You know, I a lot of questions about that, but you're right. They don't have a piece of physical evidence that puts him in the home or that he just got done stabbing somebody eight times. They don't have that.
And Todd, they gave the ex-boyfriend immunity, right?
They did. They did. They did so in a way that, you know, they apparently, I haven't seen this evidence, but apparently they ruled him out because of an alibi that was such that it was soundproof, basically, uh-huh. that they couldn't put him there. But I didn't hear that so succinctly come out in the trial. I'm sure it did, but I didn't hear it.
I saw some pictures. They showed some pictures in the court during the trial of the blood around the crime scene. It was so much blood. And for it to be that much blood and you just have a couple of drops on your coat and a little bit on your backpack, I don't know. I mean, it makes me think, too, like, you know, did he just touch the body or, you know, did he kill her? I don't know. But it was so much blood there. And you would think that it would get on a person's shoe and his pants and everything was so
right,
much blood.
Right. If you were in that heat of that battle, you would think. Common sense would dictate you would think. You got to remember, this was 6 months in time that they still found traces of blood. So it's not like it was immediate.
Yeah.
However, the other side of that is there's no, like, I mean, there was a small amount. He had a dark, she had a hoodie on herself. It was dark. But so much blood, you would think that as you see him walking the scene, away from the scene, he's going by 36th District Court and the like, that he would have been, you know, wiping off his jacket completely, maybe throwing his jacket away on the, you know, I can't have this thing around me, right? But you don't see any of those reactions in any of the footage. So, yeah, I agree with you. And we've mentioned a long time ago, and the defense picked up on this. Criminologists, I don't know if anyone ever testified to this. I know Dr. Dragovic was not able to testify about this, but criminologists will tell you, you know, that type of killing, eight stab wounds to a female is rage and one of, you know, serious
passion
action, yeah, taking place. And here, this guy doesn't have any assaultive background. He has a background of thievery. He has a background of conversion. He doesn't have a background in assaultive history. Doesn't know the victim at all. Where does this rage come from, right? That sounds crazy to me to some extent, because there's nothing like that in his history that you see. But who knows? The prosecution in this case laid out quite a bit of, and I'm seriously impressed with, you know, how succinct and clear and linear, and you could follow the story of what they put out. And we'll let the jury decide. That's what this is all about. It's all about due process. It's all about you had probable cause to believe he committed the crime. You obviously know probable cause was there for it. It was established well. He has to be there at the scene. Let due process, you know, follow its course, and the jury decide.
I just hope there's justice for this young woman whose life
right.
was snuffed out.
She
had so much going
that.
For her. And, you know, I relate being someone who lived by herself for a
sure.
while before I met my husband. I just feel so sad for her, and I hope justice is served.
Amen to that and to the family. You know, I call it the Valley of Tears, you know, because they want closure. They want to heal. They want to mourn. They mm-hmm. want to get healthy. And this is such a beautiful human being. And a senseless murder. You know, I don't know what justice is in the sense of this, except for maybe there's some modicum of mercy someplace for this family and some compassion, because what a beautiful human being when Ms. Wall was alive. So it's so sad.
Todd Flood, attorney and managing partner at Flood Law. We always appreciate your insights, my friend. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. Have a great day.
You as
you
well.
Too.
For the first time for this market, foreign-owned manufacturers turned out more vehicles in the United States last year than their rivals in Detroit. We're going to talk to Paul Eisenstein about it. He's a senior contributing editor for Headlight.News, coming up at 6:49.
For the first time in the auto market, foreign-owned manufacturers turned out more vehicles in the U.S. last year than the big three. That's according to a report from Autos Drive America and the American International Automobile Dealers Association. So this sort of shows this major shift in domestic auto production. Paul Eisenstein, senior contributing editor for Headlight.News, joins us now. Good morning, Paul.
Hey, good to be with you.
What does this number from last year tell you about where we're going in the future?
We've been seeing this steadily developed for almost 40 years, certainly since I started covering the auto industry back about 1979. Those old enough to remember that period knew that as the second energy crisis hit, we started seeing the Detroit manufacturers close plants. But by the early to mid 1980s, about 1984, in fact, we started seeing some of these so-called transplants open. These are factories run by, well, Japanese manufacturers like Honda and then Toyota. And today, essentially any manufacturer that is competing in the U.S., other than, you know, some of the really exotic brands like, say, Aston Martin, they have had at least one plant open in the United States, and in many cases, they have multiple plants. Toyota produces, something like 70% of the vehicles they sell in the U.S. or neighboring Canada or Mexico.
Paul, what does this mean for the American auto industry's future, especially in the midst of this transition to electric vehicles?
Now, that's an interesting question. We are seeing, in fact, more EV plants open in the next couple of years than we're seeing conventional vehicles. One of the good things that happened for American automotive manufacturing is the Inflation Reduction Act of a couple of years ago, because it sets a very strict minimum level of local production that manufacturers have to meet for their vehicles to qualify for the various incentives that the federal government is giving to EVs. What that means is essentially if you want to get the advantage, a sales advantage of being able to give your customers one of these incentives, you're going to have to build the vehicle in the United States or one or two neighboring countries. That said, you also have to build your batteries here, and you have to get the raw materials like lithium,
right,
cobalt, and manganese. So that's actually driving even more production in the United States. But it also means that a lot of that production will be foreign manufacturers. Hyundai, for example, is setting up in Georgia a plant specifically to build EVs, and several other manufacturers are doing the same thing.
Paul, what about this report that Ford and Michigan cut all this money and the support for the Marshall site? It seems like they're pulling back.
Yeah, we've seen Ford reduce the size of the Marshall plant. They have the capability to expand it later on, but they're trying to size their battery manufacturing to meet their anticipated sales growth over the next few years. And it makes sense. You would do that with pretty much any plant to try to make sure that you don't build something that's much larger than you expect sales to be.
And Paul, the UAW, you know, they've been really actively pursuing unionizing these foreign-owned auto plants. Now, if they become successful, it's kind of been varying successes with that, but if they become successful, how does that impact the industry competitiveness in the U.S.?
Well, it probably means that some of the Detroit manufacturers are not going to have as much of a cost penalty because the UAW is going to clearly bring up the price of labor, mm-hmm, for manufacturers that it does organize. That said, there's a lot of reports that overstate the impact of the cost of UAW labor. Labor as a part of the total cost of getting a car driven off the assembly line is less than 10%. You're spending a lot more money these days on things like advanced driver assistance or, you know, digital safety technology and the like. And a lot of the increase that we've seen in the price of vehicles in recent years is because people are going upscale and they're adding more content to their vehicles.
Paul, less than a minute, but we had Rod Maloney, who's covered autos forever, on our air last week. And he's like, we might be at peak car. Like, everyone has one, and it might be just like they can't produce as many because it's the peak moment. What do you think about that?
Yeah, we're seeing a shift. Even though people who are buying cars tend to be buying more expensive vehicles these days, the average American is facing more pressure. We're seeing the growth of used car sales as opposed to seeing any massive growth in new vehicles. We're approaching the old record. We might see 16 or 17 million, according to many analysts, but to see sales go up to, say, 20 million or above, nobody seems to have that in the forecast, at least not this decade.
Well, we will continue to watch it, as will you. Paul Eisenstein, Senior Contributing Editor for Headlight.News. Thank you for your time this morning.
Great to be with you.
Coming up on JR Morning, a challenge from President Trump to President Biden, plus what do congressional leaders think of President Biden's future? That's next. Well, Lloyd, the remnants of Hurricane Beryl are here.
Oh, my goodness.
Hopefully it's barreling out of here. See what I did there?
Oh, God. I love that. I love
that. It was tough driving today.
It was. And, you know, a lot of areas are flooded. A lot of freeway underpasses are flooded. So you got to be careful out there. But even the parts that are not flooded, it's a lot of rain, and you could still slide or hydroplane out there if you're going too fast. So please slow down.
Between 1 to 4 inches of rain, depending on where you live. I-94 was tough driving in this morning. Hopefully now it's sort of moved out, at least downtown.
Yeah.
And hopefully your area as well. But it's supposed to rain throughout the day. So double check your basements. I know city, county, local officials are ready for this. But whoo, that was a lot.
It was a lot in a small period of time.
So everyone's reacting now that they're in Washington to President Biden's candidacy. Do they think he can move forward? When reporters talked to the House Democrats who were meeting offsite, what they thought, reviews were mixed.
Right now, President Biden is the nominee, and we support the Democratic nominee. that will be Donald Trump.
He shouldn't leave a legacy that endangers us, that we surrender to a tyrant.
Trump would be an absolute disaster for democracy, so I'm enthusiastically supporting Biden.
He just has to step down because he can't win.
We're riding with Biden.
That was Jim Clyburn at the end there from South Carolina. The others were the chair of the Democratic caucus, Pete Aguilar, Lloyd Doggett, Jerry Nadler, and Mike Quigley. When it comes to the Senate, Chuck Schumer had a three-word response every time he was asked.
Are you confident that President Biden has what it takes to win in November and serve the next 4 years?
As I've said before, I'm with Joe.
Is there the ability to throw out the virtual nomination?
As I've said before, I'm with Joe.
Do you agree with her sentiment?
As I've said before, I'm with Joe.
Well, okay, so the three-word answer for it, or is he with him right now? Well, they all decide. According to some reporting, Senators Michael Bennet, Sherrod Brown, and John Tester told people in the Democratic lunch that they don't believe Biden can win the election. And Lloyd, a guy who just interviewed the man.
I know.
George for 22 minutes.
George Stephanopoulos, you know, who just interviewed him last Friday, big primetime special, was out jogging the piers out on... in New York on one of the streets there, and a guy comes up to him who was recording him, and Stephanopoulos didn't know he was being recorded, and asked him, you know, what did he think about Biden running? And Stephanopoulos said that he didn't think that he could do 4 more years. And now he's coming back to say, I probably shouldn't have said that, you know. These are my personal opinions and not the opinions of ABC News.
Right. Well, they had to say that. Meanwhile, President Biden welcomed the leaders of NATO, and he had a very forceful speech talking about democracy and why this coalition is so important.
It's good that we're stronger than ever, because this moment in history calls for our collective strength. Autocrats want to overturn global order, which is by and large kept for nearly 80 years and counting. Terrorist groups continue to plot evil schemes to cause mayhem and chaos and suffering. In Europe, Putin's war of aggression against Ukraine continues, and Putin wants nothing less than Ukraine's total subjugation.
Look, that was a good speech for him.
A little
he
state
sounded
of the union-ish.
Well, yeah, it was the State of the Union Biden, not debate Biden.
Right.
Trump was at a rally, and this idea of not taxing tips, Lloyd, he is doubling down.
Every time you leave a tip for the next 4 months, because it's going to go into effect very quickly, make sure that you write on the receipt, vote Trump for no tax on trips. No tax on tips.
Oh, he is... talked about that, and here's another way to get people
how
thinking
that
about that.
How would that work? How would you do it? None of those details discussed in this rally. Just that's what he said. He also challenged Biden to a golf match. So I'll tell you what, I'd watch it. I don't think it's going to happen, but it's kind of fun to talk
about.
Well,
and I guess it depends on where it is too, right?
Yeah. Let's bring it back local, Lloyd, and buses. New age buses are coming.
The Detroit Department of Transportation receiving $30.8 million from the U.S. Department of Transportation to buy new diesel, electric, and hydrogen fuel cell electric buses. This funding supports DDOT's transition to a green bus fleet as part of a $1.5 billion initiative funding 117 public transportation projects across 47 states. Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan highlighting the impact at a recent ceremony.
A year ago, I had more buses than drivers. Today, I've got more drivers than buses. By next year, we're going to have plenty of buses and drivers.
The grant will help replace aging buses, fund a hydrogen fueling station, and provide charging equipment for the new fleet. It also includes training for bus operators and maintenance workers on the new clean energy buses. Acting Administrator for the Federal Transit Authority, Veronica Vanderpool, presented the check at the Jason Hargrove Transit Center, emphasizing the benefits of modern, convenient buses for community access and reducing car dependence. The city plans to bring in 25 new buses, including 21 hybrids and 4 fuel cell coaches. The initiative, matched with $5 million from MDOT, brings the total investment to $36 million, advancing Detroit's path to decarbonization.
Well, I know people will appreciate the same amount of drivers and buses
yeah.
when they're going places. So
absolutely.
Shout out to the mayor there.
Yes.
When we return, we are going to continue talking about President Biden with Ryan Schmelz, who's at Capitol Hill, who's been talking to these lawmakers, what he thinks the next steps will be for the Biden campaign. It's time now for WJR's Business Beat, brought to you by Shelving.com. We rack your world. Here's Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of Startup Nation, to spotlight the entrepreneurial, tech, and startup community on WJR.
While there are clear signs now that Americans are pulling back on their spending, one thing we are not yet giving up with our spend is dining out. In fact, the nation's restaurant industry remains on track for a record year. Data from the National Restaurant Association shows that America's restaurants, from fine dining to fast food, are doing just fine in spite of all the belt tightening going on in other sectors of the American economy. Revenues from dining out this year are expected to total over $1.1 trillion, and that number sets a new record, by the way. Those reports underscore one simple fact. America has been dining out more and more, and it's showing no signs of slowing down. Additional data, this from the USDA, shows that 53% of household food expenditure is now spent on food away from home. That's up 41% since 1997. So what might we take away from this data? Well, here's one takeaway for you, and that is that experience matters when it comes to business. Whether that's experience when it comes to fine dining, fast food, perhaps even shopping or entertainment, paying for quality experiences is something that American consumers are not slowing their spending on. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com, the source for everything you need to start and grow your own business. And that's today's Business Beat on the Great Voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
We've been talking about this for a couple weeks now. This seems so cool. Unfortunately, Lloyd and I can't win, but you can. You can win a trip to see the Eagles at the Sphere Las Vegas, this awesome band, this awesome venue, the Eagles live at the Sphere Las Vegas. 16 shows, September 20th through December 14th, and you could be there. We've got two trips for two with flights, a stay at the Venetian Resort Las Vegas, dinner at Chica Las Vegas, two tickets to the show, plus this Vibe VIP experience package. All of this provided by Live Nation. To enter your chance to win, text this hour's national keyword, which is ROAD, to 95819. ROAD, R-O-A-D, 95819.
All righty, and as President Biden grapples with dwindling support within his own party, the aftermath of a poor debate performance continues to haunt him. Beyond losing broad Democratic backing, Biden is facing a crisis of credibility that extends to the media, lawmakers, top officials, and even his own staff. The significance of this situation not lost on top Democrats, who express uncertainty about Biden's ability to regain lost ground. His recent ABC interview, where he dismissed negative poll numbers and concerns within his party, has only exacerbated the issue. Let's bring in Ryan Schmelz, Fox News radio correspondent and WJR contributor, to explore what it means for the Biden administration moving forward. Ryan, good morning. Hey, Ryan, are you there? Good morning.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hey,
what? Hey, so given President Biden's declining support within his own party, I mean, has it gotten to a point where it's a point of no return, or is there some way he can salvage the campaign at this point?
Well, I think the next couple of days are going to be pivotal. That's the reality for President Biden. He's got a press conference that he's doing tomorrow. He's given a couple speeches already, and there's still going to be meetings that are happening on Capitol Hill amongst Democrats. So these next couple of days are pivotal. There have been some Democrats who have floated the idea of President Biden addressing either the House or Senate caucuses, and that certainly could be a way to shore up some support. But the reality is they had these meetings yesterday. More Democrats are expressing concerns, and we have another Democrat who's officially calling on President Biden to step aside.
Ryan, I heard it described as a trickle and not the floodgates opening. And so far this campaign continues. What are you hearing from people?
Yeah, well, the campaign continues, no doubt about that. President Biden is staying on the campaign trail and he's continuing to do events. His campaign team is continuing to send out emails. But, you know, he hasn't given any indication he's going to step aside. That's the reality of the situation right now. But Democrats are continuing to raise their questions. And I think the reality is, too, is that if they're going to do this and President Biden is going to step aside, they've got to make this decision soon, because we're less than 45 days away from the Democratic National Convention. When Lyndon B. Johnson dropped out, we were over 100 days out. So this would be a very quick turnaround for this to happen.
So if he doesn't, let's just say he doesn't drop out, you know, this weekend or this week and then go all the way to the convention, is that where something's going to have to happen?
The convention would maybe. I mean, it seems like Democrats are putting the ball in President Biden's court. Even the ones who kind of think that somebody else would be a better nominee or give them a better chance of winning, a lot of them are still saying that, well, this is President Biden's decision to make. And you heard that from both House and Senate Democrats yesterday. So it just seems like this is going to have to be President Biden's decision. They can give him a pressure campaign, but he's not going to drop out unless he makes that decision himself.
When it comes to the Senate, Chuck Schumer had this three-word answer, I'm with Joe, every time he was asked. But Senator Michael Bennet went on TV and expressed his concern.
Yeah, and he was probably the first Democratic senator to really express concerns on that level, at least on the record. So there was some reporting that a number of swing district or swing or battleground state Democrats in the Senate meeting were concerned about President Biden's ability to win. But Senator Bennet straight up went on CNN and said that he has concerns about President Biden's ability to win. And he also stopped short of calling on President Biden to step aside. So I think he's that prime example of a Democrat raising concerns about President Biden's ability to beat former President Trump, but also stopping short of asking for him to step aside.
Ryan, what do you think about George Stephanopoulos in this whole situation where he got caught by someone, on the New York street, and they asked him a question and he was being recorded, and he said he didn't think the president could do 4 more years?
Yeah, I still need to go see that clip. I actually have not seen it myself, to be honest with you.
Well, let me ask you about, on Capitol Hill, what is the feeling like? Does it feel like disarray? That's what one Republican was telling us yesterday, that the Dems are in disarray.
Well, it feels unusual. I was at Speaker Johnson's press conference yesterday. I kind of skipped the little stakeout that was going on outside for the House Democrats. And, what was fascinating was seeing Speaker Johnson get up there and joke about, the fact that there was less media at his press conference than has ever been since he became Speaker of the House. And honestly, since Republicans took back the House of Representatives. And I think that was probably one of the big moments where you're just kind of realizing that Republicans are kind of enjoying this and having a good time with this, because so much of the attention right now is just simply on Democrats and where they stand on President Biden.
I did see video of that room. It looked like there are 5 people in it.
Yeah, I was one of them. It was me and you have the front row seats, and that's usually prime seating, because it gives you the better opportunity to get called on by whoever's hosting the press conference. And I mean, we only had 3 people occupying the front row, and it was just a very surreal circumstance. So it was great. I got called on. So there we go.
What do you think needs to be done, Ryan, for the president to regain some credibility and some support from his party and the public, for that matter?
I think the NATO conference this week is going to be huge. The press conference tomorrow is going to be huge. We don't really know what that's totally going to look like just yet, but it's an opportunity for him to ask questions in a tough situation and in a tough setting and prove that he still has the chops to be president. And then also, I think there's some Democrats who floated the idea of him addressing the conference as a way to shore up support and shore up the concerns that are being expressed by some members. So I think that's going to be a big part of it. And of course, I think seeing if the polling data gets any better for him too.
I mean, tomorrow will be huge. His first solo press conference of the year, and it's July.
Right.
Yep. It's been a while. We've been fiending for this opportunity, and I think the White House press pool is going to enjoy this.
Well, here's to hoping you get a good spot.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe you get called on.
I'll be stuck here on Capitol Hill probably. Jared Halpern will probably be handling that, but you never know.
Okay. All right. Ryan Smales, Fox News radio correspondent, WJR contributor. Always a pleasure having you here, my friend. Thanks so much.
Of course. Hey, thank you so much as always.
Ford Motor Company and state officials, they're scaling back that public money for 2 electric vehicle-related projects. We're going to be talking with the CEO of the Michigan Economic Development Corporation about all of this coming up at 7:35. And good morning, and welcome to Wednesday.
Did you have to think about it?
I had to think about it. It's hump day. happy hump day. And boy, was it a hump this morning.
Oh, the drive.
Getting into this place.
The road 94 was so flooded on the sides. So I stayed in the middle lane and also under the overpasses. It was just, it was tough.
A lot of water out there, and the Great Lakes Water Authority telling people, listen, if you're prone, if you live in a flood-prone area, you know, make sure you check your basements. Make sure you get all of the things that you really want out of there and get them off of the floor, because it's 3 to 4 inches of water. Inches like 10 inches of snow if it was snowing.
Yeah, and the systems are going to be overwhelmed. Like, that was a lot of water. And this is an unofficial way to measure, but I have a little water table for our little baby outside.
Yes.
And it collected all the water so far at 5 a.m. It was overflowing.
Wow.
And, it was tough this morning. So it's nice to have this reprieve now.
You know, there's an Indiana man, Jamie, who has been sentenced to 14 months for sending death threats to a Michigan election worker following the November 2020 election. His name, 38-year-old Andrew Nichols. He was sentenced yesterday. Court documents revealing on or around November 10th, Nichols of 2020, Nichols left a threatening voicemail for a local municipality clerk in Michigan. He accused the clerk of election fraud, stating you're going to pay for it, and warned that 10 million plus patriots will surround you when you least expect it. I mean, he said some really, really bad things that I can't repeat again on our radio. But he pleaded guilty in February to a count of making a threatening interstate communication. And this investigation was done by the FBI Detroit field office, but 14 months in prison for making those threats.
And we are hoping to have Quentin Messer, CEO of the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, to talk to us because, oh, he's there.
Okay.
So we'll let him talk about it instead of us.
That's right, because recent Ford Motor Company and state economic officials announced substantial cuts to public funding for major electric vehicle initiatives, citing challenges in the EV market. And the decision reducing taxpayer support by over $750 million marks a pivotal moment for Michigan's auto industry and its strategic economic policies. And on the JR Morning Live line to give more perspective is the CEO of the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, Quentin Messer. Quentin, good morning.
Good morning. How you doing?
Doing well. What brought the MEDC to this point to scale back on the funding for these projects?
Well, thanks for affording us the opportunity. I really think there are three things. One, as the industry itself has noted, we need to make sure that we scale appropriately to match consumer demand and consumer appetite. So that's one. Two, I think we wanted to do it in such a way that we continue to maintain this important relationship with Ford, and we have similar conversations in the background with the other leading automakers in the state, whether it's GM, Stellantis, or Toyota. And I think the third thing is, I think hope the listeners understand this, is our desire to be responsible stewards. We want to make sure that as federal industrial policy supports this transition, that Michigan continues to compete, but it has to do it at a level that is fiscally prudent. And that's what Ford and the state came together, and that's what we accomplished yesterday.
So it was proposed $825 million in tax credits for this EV battery plant. The automakers decide to change course a little bit. Does this show why you have protections for public subsidies? Like, Ford didn't receive that money yet, right?
No, you're absolutely right. They haven't. And that's why you have protections. The listeners should realize every dime of dollars that are approved by the Michigan Strategic Fund are basically performance reimbursement. What does that mean? The company has to perform and reach certain milestones before it receives a dime. And I think Ford realized, hey, look, given where consumer demand is, given our desires to be competitive in the future, we need to scale back so that we can meet milestones that are reasonable given where the consumer market is today. And this is fast approaching, fast changing, and we have to be flexible. And that's why, as you noted, we do have these protections.
And Quentin, how does the MEDC assess any future investment opportunities in electric vehicles?
Very, very carefully. I think there are a couple of things. One, you know, is the investment thesis supported by either the private investment commitment You know, Ford has made commitments and continued investments well in excess of $2.5 billion. So is that there?
Mm-hmm.
Two, is there a proven track record? Ford has been around for, you know, over 120 years. Three, is there federal government support? And then four, is there proven market reality and adaption? You know, is this a company that's proven that they have the consumer willing to purchase these opportunities? But it is something that we're constantly refining. We want to make sure that we are as prudent stewards. We take very seriously that role for our friends and neighbors across the state.
There was this the battery plant deal, and then there's this other deal with Ford that they were going to invest in each site and create a certain number of jobs at each site. And there was this deadline of June 30th. Did they meet that deadline or not?
So overall, Ford did meet the deadline. But as the original deal was constructed, they had to meet the deadline at each of the individual facilities. And because they made adjustments based upon what they were seeing in the from consumers in the marketplace, they were not able to do so and said, hey, look, we want to maintain the flexibility to add capacity at certain of the sites and reduce capacity depending upon consumer reactivity to the particular product. So overall they did, but as the deal was constructed, they would not have met the requirements for each individual plant. That's why we decided to cancel that agreement or rescind that agreement, I should say.
Were there any lessons learned by the MEDC from the Ford projects in terms of managing expectations and economic forecast and public-private partnerships?
Great question. You know, I think there are always lessons learned. So I think one is we need to make sure that we manage expectations that there's not certainty on consumer demand.
Mm-hmm.
I think everyone felt that there were going to be, and there's still quarter over quarter, more and more consumers are purchasing electric vehicles. They're just not purchasing at the rate that had been forecast.
Right.
I think that's been known. And so that's one. The second thing is, continue to educate the public that because there is a commitment, that doesn't mean that those dollars go out the door. The dollars only go out the door when there is performance met, and then the dollars go. And I think the third thing is just making sure that we have people understand that there is a broader strategy, the Make It in Michigan economic development strategy focused on people, places, and projects. You can simultaneously attract and develop people, cultivate and revitalize places, and compete for and win projects. And that will allow communities across Michigan to have not only employment growth, but entrepreneurial growth and the positive knock-on benefits of having opportunities like Blue Oval Battery Park, Michigan.
Quint Messer is CEO of the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. Quint, we appreciate you this morning coming on and giving us that information.
I'm so grateful for the opportunity to continue to stay safe and well.
You as well. He tweeted that the president should pass the torch to a new generation of leaders. He is a state representative from East Grand Rapids, a Democrat. We'll be speaking with him next with our Capitol report at 7:49.
Could President Biden's candidacy affect those down ballot, especially those in state office running for their seats? That's the topic of today's Capitol Report, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Health and Hospital Association, Truscott Rossman, and the Michigan Chamber of Commerce. Now, we believe we have the first Democratic state lawmaker who has come out and called for President Biden to step aside. State Representative Phil Skaggs of East Grand Rapids joins us now. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning. Nice to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
So we've certainly, you know, heard from congressional Democrats. You may be the first state lawmaker here. And it started with, what was it, a tweet yesterday?
Started with a tweet and a Facebook post up on social media, correct.
Give us the gist of what you said and why you felt like you needed to post.
I mean, none of this gives me any happiness. It gives me no joy. Joe Biden, I think, has been a very impressive president. and he's a good human being. But I think that, as he says, I think as many Americans understand, this is a historic election that we have coming up. The other party is poised to nominate an individual who is a 34-time convicted felon, who was twice impeached by the U.S. House of Representatives, and who was capable of sending a mob to the Capitol building to try to overturn a free and fair American election and install himself as a dictator. So Donald Trump simply cannot be reelected. And as the grown-ups in the room, I believe that the Democratic Party needs to make sure that we have the strongest possible nominee to go up against Donald Trump, because I firmly believe that our Democratic Republic is at stake. And I don't want to lose that democracy that has been handed down to us from the founders on my watch. So I think that we still have time left, and I've asked the president to stick to a single term and pass the torch to a new generation.
Representative, you know, the Democrats here in the state, they're facing some critical races this year, including some tight congressional races and maintaining the state House majority. How do you think the president's candidacy as it stands could affect those down ballot races?
Well, I came to my conclusion mostly after talking to countless constituents on the doors during my campaign, out in the community. And what I am concerned about is not that Biden voters are going to switch over and suddenly vote for Donald Trump. Everyone is pretty sure about their values and how they align with the two political parties. What I am most concerned about is a decline in turnout. Now, there's also maybe a problem with people switching over to third parties at the top of the ticket, but for the down ballot races, it is the top of the ticket that drives turnout in elections. And you want to make sure that you have at the top of the ticket, in this case, the presidency, an effective communicator, a campaign that is running on all engines firing, and that will bring out young people, voters that maybe only vote in presidential elections, maybe only sometimes. And those voters will tend to stay on the Democratic side of the ballot as they go down to Senate, Congress, State House, local offices. And so it's extraordinarily important that we have the best nominee for president possible because of the effect that it has on down ballot races. And as you mentioned, we have many important congressional races out here in West Michigan. We need to reelect Hillary Scolton, but there are races throughout the state. And then we have a two-seat majority in the state house, and we need to do everything we possibly can to retain that majority and keep doing the good work that we've been doing for the last 2 years.
Representative Phil Skaggs, that's who we're speaking with right now. Has there been any discussion among Democrats statewide? I know, like, the U.S. House, the U.S. Senate are meeting behind closed doors. Is there any discussions in our state?
No, we're all having individual discussions. I believe that we'll be meeting as a caucus later this week. But at this moment, it is mostly we are talking on the phone and we are running into each other in the community and comparing our notes and our thoughts. Some of my colleagues are coming to different conclusions. It's very difficult to call on a successful sitting president to not run for reelection. And I understand the calculus that they've made. I just made a different calculus.
And Representative, when you talk about passing the torch to a new generation of leaders, who are those leaders? Who is that new generation?
Well, it's no secret that Democrats have an extraordinary strong bench of leaders at the state level and at the federal level, who I think are ready to step up and be excellent presidents in the White House, but also be effective communicators and really formidable candidates in this crucial race against Donald Trump. Who might some of those be? The media has discussed several. Obviously, our Vice President Kamala Harris is one of those, in addition to our Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. But there are, I think, several others that could be included in this discussion. Gavin Newsom, the Governor of California, Wes Moore, the Governor of Maryland, Josh Shapiro in Pennsylvania. There's a deep bench of candidates who I think are ready to step forward and put their name in front of the convention delegates to the Democratic convention here in August.
Do you feel like some are afraid to make a public post like yours or what have you? Because if he remains the candidate, I mean, how do you come back from that?
Yeah, this is the difficult calculus that I talked about. I don't think anyone wants to undermine our nominee at this crucial juncture when we're going against a candidate in Donald Trump who said he wanted to be a dictator on day one. Who says that? What kind of an American says that? So people are reticent, but I simply feel, and the discussions that I've had and the polling that I've read, I've run many campaigns myself. I've been on the ballot, more than a handful of times. As I talk to my constituents, the American people are excited, thrilled if the Democrats came to them and said, we have an alternative. We have a new alternative. People are fired up to not vote for Donald Trump. They just want to make sure that the president that Democrats put forward is someone that they can be enthusiastic about.
Well, Representative Phil Skaggs, a Democrat from East Grand Rapids, we appreciate your time expounding on this topic that it's difficult, as you said, to decide where to go, how to move forward.
Well, I hope that the party will be able to make its decision here in a couple of weeks, and then we will be united going into the late summer and fall, and we'll defeat Donald Trump and save the American Republic.
Thank you, Representative, for that Capitol report. Coming up on JR Morning, Samantha Wohl. Will we get a decision today? We'll talk about that next.
Where's that guy, Gordon?
He's missing all this rain,
I hope. Yes.
He's still up north enjoying his family time. But down here, it is wet.
It is wet.
It was a tough drive in this morning. Tons of rain this morning.
Yeah, and a lot of accidents. And people just think that, you know, accidents only happen when it snows outside or when it's icy outside. But they also happen when it's wet and you can hydroplane, when you get that water building up in those far right lanes and the far left lanes. And even in the middle lane, where you might not have a whole bunch of water, it's still slippery out there and you have to watch your speeds.
Absolutely. But we do have a little reprieve, at least here downtown, so that's good news. Does President Biden have a reprieve in the media? He does not, because even though he had a forceful and clear message at the NATO summit, the talk of him stepping down or not stepping down continues. The House Democrats met behind closed doors. But of course, when they were coming out of those doors, all the reporters asking them what they think and reactions were mixed.
Right now, President Biden is the nominee and we support the Democratic nominee that will be Donald Trump.
He shouldn't leave a legacy that endangers us, that we surrender to a tyrant.
Trump would be an absolute disaster for democracy, so I'm enthusiastically supporting Biden.
He just has to step down because he can't win.
You're riding with Biden.
And you heard that right there. Reporters asked one of the congressmen, are you guys on the same page? And he goes, we're not even in the same book.
No, that's bad.
And you could hear that there. On the Senate side, Chuck Schumer hosted a press conference. He was asked multiple times about Biden. He had the exact same answer every time.
Are you confident that President Biden has what it takes to win in November and serve the next 4 years?
As I've said before, I'm with Joe.
Is there an ability to throw out the virtual nomination.
As I've said before, I'm with Joe.
Do you agree with her sentiment?
As I've said before, I'm with Joe.
Clearly that was planned.
He's with Joe.
What was not planned was George Stephanopoulos getting asked a question on the street. He's in workout gear. It's a viral video now. And he answered, it seems, honestly, Lloyd.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he was out on Fifth Avenue, you know, had his, you know, gym clothes on and out jogging. And a pedestrian comes up to him and approaches him.
Hey, excuse me. Hey, how you doing? What do you think? Do you think Biden should step down? You talked to him more than anybody else have lately. And you could be honest. You don't think he can serve 4 more years? All right. That's an answer.
Now, his remarks come among the ongoing scrutiny over Biden's age and the recent debate performance. Now, Stephanopoulos told TMZ that he regrets commenting publicly and emphasized his remarks were his own personal opinion, not reflective of ABC News. But, of course, he didn't know he was
being recorded.
But
I guess assume you're always being recorded.
Nowadays, either audio or video.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A state representative here in Michigan has come out and said he thinks President Biden should pass the torch to a new generation of leaders. His name is Representative Phil Skaggs. You can listen to his full interview. We talked to him on WJR.com. So he is making his views very clear, as is Donald Trump. He was at a rally after about 10 days off. He hosted it in Florida and he weighed in. You know, what if they make Kamala Harris the new person at the top of the ticket?
I don't think Kamala Harris's California socialism is going to go down well with the people of Doral, the people of Miami, or the people of Florida. Because in Florida, we don't like socialism. We want our freedom.
We're waiting for his VP pick, and I heard him say that they're kind of waiting to see what the Democrats do before they make their pick. Perhaps it'll be at the convention that is very soon. One thing that's kind of funny, this golf thing.
Oh, my goodness.
He talked about golf once again at the rally.
I'm also officially challenging Crooked Joe to an 18-hole golf match right here. On Doral's Blue Monster, considered one of the greatest tournament golf courses anywhere in the world.
The golf themes and memes live on because he's continuing to talk about it. It would be hilarious, but there's, you know, serious business to be done. No. NATO's in town. Let's not discuss golf anymore.
Oh, well, you got closing arguments concluded yesterday, Jamie, in the murder trial of Michael Jackson Bolanos. He's accused of killing Samantha Wall, the prominent Jewish leader in Detroit. The jury will begin deliberations this morning. Jackson Bolanos faces charges of first-degree murder, home invasion, and lying to a peace officer. Prosecutors allege Wall was killed during a break-in attempt, while the defense says Jackson Bolanos is a thief, but he's not a killer. On the stand, Jackson Bolanos admitted to lying to police and claimed he discovered Wall's body while breaking into cars. He said his jacket, with a few drops of Wall's blood, got stained when he checked if she was alive. Defense attorney Brian Brown suggesting Wall's ex-boyfriend, Jeffrey Herbsman, was the real culprit, pointing to Herbsman's initial confession and physical similarities to the suspect and surveillance footage.
This person running from the scene looks very similar to Jeff Herbsman. Haircut, glasses, even the coat he's wearing. Now, why don't we have the video of where this person ran to?
Assistant prosecutor Ryan Elsley argued that the evidence, including surveillance video and blood on Jackson Bolanos' clothing, clearly points to his guilt.
The accusations they've made against Jeff Herbsman are unsupported. We are accusing the defendant of murder, and we backed it up with serious evidence. The only time that motion is detected in her home, after her phone stops being used, the defendant's right there. And then as he's leaving, he's got her blood on him. The blood tells the story in this case, and it tells the story of the defendant's guilt.
Now, is there a reasonable doubt? Well, jurors will have the task of determining that truth today as deliberations get underway.
And I just want justice for that young woman who had her whole life ahead of her, and she was, you know, beloved by the community. So justice, whatever that means. Mm-hmm. I hope that her family can find it. Did you hear this? Like last year, Florida became the first state to crack down on phones in schools with a new law. Then it was Indiana and Ohio passing their own laws. Well, now Virginia is considering it. And this is something we've talked about on this air with superintendents about how kids will get like 50 alerts in an hour or so when they are sitting there in school.
Mm-hmm.
How can they concentrate on school if their phones are going off? Well, Virginia, like I said, considering it, Glenn Youngkin's order has the full support of the superintendent of public schools in that state. And, you know, as my daughter grows up, I think I'd like to see that here too.
Yeah. I mean, because a lot of times kids are getting calls from their parents. You know, the parents are just as hyped as the kids are about the phones, you know, and getting to be able to talk to their kids. But a lot of times those messages are, what do you want for dinner? In the middle of a test.
This immediacy that we have in our lives,
exactly.
That we have to text and then get a response right back. I feel it too. When someone texts me, I feel like I got to answer, but you don't.
No.
You don't. Not in school, not when you're driving either.
Exactly.
Coming up on JR Morning, a national park here in our state. Is it the best one in the U.S.? The Wall Street Journal thinks so. We're going to talk about that at 8:19. Summer storms can be unexpected here in Michigan. I mean, we just had a ton of rain throughout the night into the morning, and rain can really wreak havoc on our plumbing systems. In my home, we have these clogged pipes that we have tree roots in our yard. Debris can build up. As I've said before, I called Shelby Mechanical to get this hydrojetting service. Their staff is amazing. They clear up everything, so we have no plumbing issues. And I texted my husband this morning, how's the basement? And he says, it's clear, it's dry. This summer, Shelby Mechanical wants to give you ways to save. How about $150 off a hydrojetting service when getting your sewer lines clean? Or get $100 off sewer dig repair. Get $100 off a new water heater install. Take advantage of these summer discounts. To get same day or next day plumbing service, call Shelby Mechanical for your home or office at 586-726-9444 or visit shelbymechanical.net. That's shelbymechanical.net. For projects big and small, you know who to call. Shelby Mechanical for all those plumbing needs.
Well, nestled in the pristine waters of Lake Superior, Isle Royale National Park has recently claimed the title of Best in the U.S. by the Wall Street Journal, surpassing even iconic destinations like Denali National Park and Preserve. This accolade highlights not only the park's natural beauty, but also its unique ecological significance. And joining us on the JR Morning Live line is Liz Valencia. She's Program Manager and Public Information Officer at Isle Royale National Park. Liz, good morning and congratulations.
Oh, thank you, and good morning. Pleasure to be with you.
Were you surprised at this recognition?
Well, yeah, we were. I don't know that people in Michigan were surprised because I think a lot of people already thought Isle Royale was the best park. but yeah, you never know when these kinds of articles are going to come out. And yeah, it's always nice to see an article that highlights some of the special attributes of our park.
So it beats out Denali, Yellowstone, Big Bend. What does your park have that they don't?
I think it's what we don't have that they have. And I think the biggest thing is cars. That's really what sets Isle Royale apart. People can't drive here. And so the number of people who can get here is limited based on ferries, private boats, and float planes. And so I think that's really, it's an island. So that's really what makes it different. And I think it's the main thing that's kept the place pretty, pretty unique and pretty special all these years.
You know, crowd size played a big role in the top ranking for you guys as well. And how does the park maintain the serene and the pristine environment, and you have that growing interest in outdoor recreation as well?
Yeah, that's a challenge in a lot of parks, and especially during COVID and after, people really wanted to get out and get outside. And so there's a few things that keep Isle Royale more uncrowded than other parks. One, I mentioned already, is access. There are only limited ways to get there. Also, we're closed in the wintertime, and so that keeps the island preserved to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
And then the park is designated wilderness, so we do have requirements for, you know, where we'll build more trails and where and when we might build campgrounds, and so we're limited in doing that because 99% of the actual land portion of the park is designated wilderness. So that also limits the amount of expansion. So we're basically, you know, looking at the number of visitors and we're assessing their experience, because for us, A visitor experience is an important part of Isle Royale, and I think that's part of what that article is getting to as well, is that people can come to Isle Royale and really still have a pretty good wilderness experience.
Well, actually, the Wall Street Journal wrote, "This is true wilderness, a land of moose and wolves and the drama forever playing out between them."
Yeah, it is. And people are seeing, people see moose. There's not a lot of places you can go and see moose, and that's pretty special, and foxes. So, less people on the trails and no cars. The wildlife is around more. I really think that happens. And it does happen in Isle Royale for sure.
And how does the park balance the conservation goals with providing the opportunities for the visitors to experience like that natural beauty?
Yeah, we actually are doing a wilderness plan right now, and it's focused on preserving the wilderness experience for visitors. So, it was interesting. The article mentioned that Isle Royale is uncrowded, and it is in certain places. But in other places that you go, in some of the campgrounds, some of the trails that are near the ferry entry points can be quite crowded. So the uncrowded nature of the park really kind of depends on when and where you go. But one thing that we're doing is we're trying to make sure that we're assessing where the campgrounds are too crowded and providing alternatives for people. We are not expanding the ferry services or the float plane service or anything like that. So the number will continue to be limited. So we're, trying to work on circulation of people where they're going when they are at the park. And so that helps with visitor experience, but then controlling numbers also helps with preservation, conservation of the natural resources too.
Liz, this park is located 55 miles from the tip of the Keweenaw Peninsula. As you said, two ways to get there. It's this 45-mile main island and then a lot of small islands around it. If you've never been there, what would you suggest people do?
Oh, that's a great question, because a lot of people, I think, are going to read this article or hear about it and then say, oh, I want to go there. So,
yeah.
And so we're really interested in people being prepared before they come. In fact, we spend a lot of time with trip planning, pre-trip planning information, and how visitors can help Isle Royale stay wild is the focus of our campaign. So a lot of it is being prepared. So knowing what you need to take with you, knowing where you can leave from, the idea of self-rescue in case you get in an emergency. Cell phones just don't work. So people have to be prepared for that. And then, if the visitors who come, and a lot of the visitors who come back time and time again, and they really do have this sense of respecting Isle Royale, being prepared. It really takes an extra few steps when you can't just drive up to a park and start camping. If people are going to go backpacking, they have to make sure they have a way to purify their water. They have to have a stove so they can cook. There's just a lot of extra pieces that visitors need to be prepared for. So that's really one of the main things that we're always talking with visitors about, is how to be prepared to go to Isle Royale. And if you're prepared, then you'll have a much better experience. But one other thing that people kind of, I think, they miss, and the article, I think, briefly mentioned it but didn't highlight it, is that there is a lodge and on both ends of the island. So for people who don't camp or don't want to camp, you can still go and experience Isle Royale, do day hikes. You can stay at the lodge. You can eat at the restaurant. All of that takes pre-planning, and also because – there's limited spaces in the lodge, so if people are planning a trip at this point in the season, they may still be able to squeeze on a ferry, but I think people have to be looking at coming next year if they read this article and say, oh, I want to go there, because most of the ferries are full. The seaplane probably has a few open spots here and there. The lodge is mostly full, so it really is something that you have to plan ahead for.
And Liz, looking down the road, how does Isle Royale National Park plan to maintain this status as a top destination?
Well, we are working on, as I mentioned, a wilderness plan. And part of that plan is dealing to a certain extent with some of the overcrowding in the campgrounds that we're seeing. Because when people go to a wilderness park, they don't expect to run into a campground that's full or overfull. And so we're working on some ideas about limiting the number of backcountry camping permits that we'll issue. Also thinking about the idea of having people getting those permits in advance so we can sort out where everybody is and where they're going. And so we're really focusing quite a bit of attention on that, on the campers and on the wilderness experience, and trying to deal with some of the places that the campgrounds really are getting overcrowded. For some people, they would come here after they've been to an incredibly busy campground park with, you know, the huge RVs and, you know, 350 sites. And they might look at Daisy Farm Campground, which is our largest that only has 36 campsites, and say, wow, that's not crowded at all.
Yeah.
But for Isle Royale, it can be if we have people who have to share a site that's not what you expect and not what you want at a wilderness park.
All right. Liz Valencia, she's Program Manager and Public Information Officer at the Isle Royale National Park. We appreciate you being here this morning. And once again, congratulations.
Oh, thank you very much. It was a pleasure. I could talk about Isle Royale all day.
The real motivation behind this reform was basically money.
They basically pull the rug from under the care providers and the catastrophically injured.
The number one reason for bankruptcy in America is medical bills. And some of the highest medical bills are in catastrophic auto accidents.
The case for auto no-fault reform, or at least the way it was put forward, was lower insurance rates. As it's turned out, that hasn't occurred.
That's a little taste of an upcoming documentary called Unintended Consequences about Michigan's 2019 auto no-fault insurance reform and its impact on the catastrophically injured. Joining us now is A.C. Rowe, CEO of Ugly Dog Entertainment. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Just fine, thank you. We've had Chad Livengood of the Detroit News on a lot of times talking about his reporting about this little six-year-old girl, Annabelle Marsh, paralyzed at age 3, and this home care company that says it's owed $1.3 million in underpayments after all of these changes. So is that sort of the basis that brought you into this topic?
You know, Annabelle, her story is absolutely heartbreaking, and the work that AdvisorCare is doing for Annabelle is amazing. We actually came into the project through a friend of ours. My partner and I, Rick Van Meter, came in. Our friend Charles Archibald is a victim of a catastrophic auto accident. Mm. And we had just wrapped our show, The Conversations Project, on Hulu, and we were in development for another project, and Chuck called us and he said, guys, there's some really rotten stuff going on. We need you to come take a look at this. And so we started having phone calls and Zoom interviews and decided we think this is a project and we need to get to Michigan. And we got to Michigan and set up a series of interviews, and we were so appalled by what we saw that was going on and all of the information that doesn't seem to make any sense at all, that we said, you know what, we sat in a hotel room the last night we were in Michigan and said, we can't wait to finish this project to put something out. So we decided to go ahead and release the 4-minute clip we have on YouTube. You can find it at, just search for our company, Ugly Dog Entertainment, on YouTube, and you can see the clip. But we found out that, you know, people are actually dying as a result of this legislation that Governor Whitmer passed, saying she knows it's not perfect and they will fix it. And they didn't fix the legislation before implementing it. And now as many as 15, maybe that we know about, 15 people have died as a result of the change in this law. And, you know, one of the really appalling things is we come in to be objective, right? We want to hear the story, but nobody that was in support or is still in support of this bill or refusing to take action will even talk to us at this point. Mm. We're hoping to talk to the governor's office and find out why. We're hoping to talk to Anita Fox at DIFS, We'd like to talk to Mike Shirkey and Lana Tice. We would like, you know, one of the people I'd really like to talk to is Brenda Carter, who is the chairman of the insurance committee. And there is a bill that has passed the Senate that will fix this. However, they won't even have a hearing on the Senate bill in the House. And one of the things we found that was quite appalling was this is not happening. And she has a career in insurance, Brenda Carter.
Mm-hmm.
And Anita Fox, who's supposed to be the watchdog, is a career-long insurance attorney. It seems like a lot of conflict of interest to us. And we do hope to present an objective, because we're halfway through production. We hope to present a completely objective story. However, these people aren't talking to us right now.
AC, I'm sorry, AC. You know, I was looking at that clip that's on YouTube, and one of the things was asked, like, who could fix it? Let's hear a little bit of that clip.
Who's the one person that could fix this problem?
The one person who could attempt to fix this problem would be the governor.
Governor Whitmer?
Governor Whitmer.
Governor Whitmer.
Anita Fox.
Brenda Carter.
Speaker Joe Tate.
Speaker Joe Tate.
4 years ago, it was unintended. It may have been unintended, but it's not anymore. It's not.
And that's my question, AC. I mean, they said it was unintended consequences, but okay, so now you know that it's people are dying. You're saying it in your documentary. People are dying. So what's next?
You know, what's next is they have to this term. And again, I'm trying to remain objective about all of this, but they have to at least have discussions this term. They need to put this bill up for a vote. And I think it'll pass. From what I've been told, it will pass. We want to continue to document all of that. If there is a reason to not do it, what I would like to hear is hear from the people who are not taking action,
mm-hmm.
or the people who are standing in the way, who say it shouldn't happen. And, you know, what we've been led to believe through our investigation, our research, our interviews, is the big player in all of this that we really want to hear from, and they have refused to speak with us. They have offered to give us, if we submit questions to them, they will record their answer and send it to it, is the Insurance Alliance of Michigan. And we have some things you don't see in that clip. We have had interviews that said that the insurance lobby is placing undue influence on legislators, and that anybody that votes against this or votes for the reform to the reform, they will run campaigns, and I don't know this to be a fact, but we have been told this. They will run campaigns against them saying they're trying to raise your insurance rates. And I understand insurance rates in Michigan are among the highest in the country, mm-hmm. and that the prices that we saw were absolutely ridiculous. But we had somebody give us one of their insurance bills, and we looked at it, and their catastrophic claims piece of their bill,
mm-hmm.
was only 2% of their overall bill. You're talking $200 a year is what people were paying for catastrophic care. And somehow this got painted as the big reason that insurance rates are as ridiculous as they are there. And as a result of this bill, insurance rates didn't come down. The insurance lobby, from what we've seen, and again, I don't know this to be fact, but the insurance, and that's why we want to talk to them. We want to understand what their side of the story is, what the reason for the reform is. But they had a very big hand in writing this bill, is what it appears to us. Again, we don't know that to be fact. And insurance rates hadn't gone down. They took this one little piece, and they didn't allow for the care of the catastrophically injured inside of it. They painted that as the big reason insurance rates were high. Rates haven't come down, even with that coming out. They're still doing incredibly shady things. The money all lives inside of the MCCA as best we can tell. And I've heard numbers from as low as 18 million to 18 billion to 30 billion dollars inside of the MCCA. But we don't really know what's going on inside of that organization, which is why we want to interview them. They're not subject to the Freedom of Information Act. We went to their offices. I don't know if anybody's been to their offices, but their offices are in a half abandoned, it's half shopping mall, half office complex, 90% abandoned. You walk in, you see a weird trophy shop, you see a movie theater. This doesn't feel like where $28 billion would live. Mm-hmm. But we went to their offices and we tried to open the door and we had our cameras with us and the doors are locked. There's a phone number to call on the door. We call the phone number and the number on the piece of paper is disconnected. Then we call another number and some guy who sounded half asleep answered the phone and said, "Nobody works in that building. Why are you there?" There are questions that need to be answered.
It seems like you have a lot of questions. Like you came into this story not knowing much, and now I can hear the passion in your voice that you want to get to the bottom of it. WJR tweeted out the clip, the teaser of this upcoming documentary. We're at the end of our interview here, AC, but when will it come out? Do you know yet?
So we're in the middle of production. We don't know when we'll get to the end of the story. You know, hopefully we get a resolution. They pass a reform to the reform this year. We can wrap everything up. But I feel like this one's going to be a little while because there's more to the story and there's still answers that we need before we can release the film.
It's certainly a compelling story, especially Annabelle's. The documentary is called Unintended Consequences. AC Rowe, CEO of Ugly Dog Entertainment, thank you for your time this morning and we'd love to have you back as this progresses.
Thank you so much.
All right, coming up, switching gears a little bit to the Pistons. They're going to introduce their brand new coach, Cade Cunningham, sticking around. We're going to talk to Steve Courtney at 8:49. The Pistons are going to introduce officially J.B. Bickerstaff later on this afternoon. Plus, they extended Cade Cunningham for a whole bunch of money, and summer league's coming up. So Steve Courtney, WJR Sports Analyst, has a lot to talk about when it comes to the Pistons. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Jamie. Hello again, everyone. This Piston Conversation brought to you by the Performance Remodeling Sweepstakes. Performance Remodeling, a preferred partner of the Inside Outside guys, they kicked off another $100,000 Window of Opportunity Sweepstakes. Request your windows, roofing, and siding quote today. Log into windowsroofingsiding.com to enter the Performance Remodeling Sweepstakes. Yes, the Pistons have secured the franchise. Cade Cunningham has indeed agreed on that 5-year, $224 million maximum rookie extension that could be elevated to as much as $269 million, this according to his agents. Now, just a review, Mr. Cunningham, the number one overall pick in the 2021 NBA draft. He can take the deal to 30% of the team's salary cap with the earning of All-NBA honors next season. Pistons president of basketball operations, Trajan Langdon, whose head has been on a swivel since he took the job, made Cunningham's extension a priority upon taking over the job just a few weeks ago. Now, interesting story here with Cade. After missing most of his second season with that stress fracture in his left leg, he had his best performance as a pro just last year. Although, point out, the Pistons coming off a historically poor season. He averaged 22.7 points, 7.5 assists, and he shot 86.9% from the charity stripe. As you mentioned, James, J.B. Bickerstaff, to be officially announced, he is going to be Cunningham's third coach in three seasons. Hopefully, Mr. Bickerstaff will stick around for a little bit. Meanwhile, there was another roster addition from Trajan Langdon. Pistons announcing they have claimed center B-Ball Paul Reed, formerly of the Philadelphia 76ers. He's 25 years of age. He was waived by the 76ers earlier this week to clear cap space for other free agent signings. He was 1 year into a three-year, $24 million contract that he signed with Philadelphia. Poor guy, worked hard. He became the backup center for Joel Embiid, and then he lost his spot this offseason. Interesting enough, the 76ers bringing aboard for the former Piston, Andre Drummond. All right, you mentioned we've got summer league activity getting underway coming up this weekend. We know that Ron Holland and Bobby Klintman will suit up for the Pistons for the first time. Pistons announcing their roster for the upcoming Las Vegas Summer League Showcase just yesterday. Their two draft picks in the 2024 NBA draft, of course, will be on hand. Second-year guard Marcus Sasser, the number 25 pick in the 2023 draft, is also going to be in the lineup. However, 2023 number 5 overall pick Asar Thompson was left off the roster after he was shut down for the final 2 months of his rookie season because of that blood clot. The Pistons Summer League squad have four opponent sets starting on Saturday at 7 o'clock against the aforementioned 76ers. Here's how it works. The top four teams in the Las Vegas Summer League advance to a two-round playoff, while the rest of the teams are scheduled for a fifth consolation game. The team will be coached by assistant Jarrett Jack for the second straight summer. So there you go. Lots of Pistons news. And, you know, quite frankly, I think I speak for everyone when I say I certainly hope it pays off.
Yeah, I mean, I've been around not even that long here in town. There have been a lot of different coaches.
Yeah, and you know what? You can't build cohesion with the way things have gone. And you know what, Jamie? And I believe Lloyd is also there.
Yes.
How are you, my friend?
I'm good.
You know, the problem with the Pistons, they've been so poor for so long. They have come across probably the most unfortunate scenario of a sports franchise, and that's indifference with the hometown fans.
Right.
And, you know, it's sad because Lord knows we had our moments with this franchise.
Yes, we have.
But again, back-to-back worst season in the NBA as far as the record goes. But you bring Cade Cunningham into the fold for a long period of time. You're working on some consistency there. So hopefully, you know, and as I mentioned, new president of basketball operations, Trajan Langdon. Oh, he has been a busy guy. So hopefully, and I'm not saying that, you know, this Piston team is going to be a postseason contender this year. But I do appreciate what J.B. Bickerstaff brings to the deal. He was in Cleveland, back-to-back postseason appearances there. Oddly enough, it wasn't enough. So now he's on the Piston bench,
right.
And
but,
that's awesome.
And it's a tall task for anybody at this point. But, you know, you got Cunningham now locked in, and it kind of gives Bickerstaff a key building block to build around.
Yeah, and I appreciate the roster moves thus far that Trajan Langdon has gone through. They re-sign the Italian Stallion, Simone Fontecchio. He showed some flashes of brilliance. So, you know, I don't think this Piston team, the way it's set up right now, it's going to take a little bit of time to gel, but hopefully they'll do just that.
Well, just like the Lions, this new staff coming in, Trajan Langdon, has nothing to do with the history of the Pistons recently.
No.
And so, just like the Lions, hopefully he can turn things around mm-hmm. quickly. And in basketball, you can. There's not that many guys on the court at one time.
That's right.
Steve Courtney, thank you for your time this morning. I mean, it's pretty wet out there. I don't think you're going to get out on the golf course.
Oh, it's coming down right now, I'll tell you that much. But, you know, I
you
know
can
my
watch
lawn
YouTube
appreciates
videos.
It.
Instructional YouTube golf videos until the race.
It's a waste of time.
Steve, thank you so
Steve.
Much.
Have a great day, folks.
And Lloyd, you have a great rest of the week.
I will be
You're going to have some guest hosts. That's what we call a tease.
A tease, yes.
Coming up. And I'm looking at Kevin Dietz. I feel like all talk, it's happening.
A lot of water out there.